What are some of the more interesting real estate deals you've done in your career? What are the things you look for that might signal to you that something is a good investment? Looking into your crystal ball for the next 10 years, what do you see for the future of Maine? Welcome to the Bolus Beat podcast. This is a series providing insight into today's real estate movers and shakers. The Bolus Company is Northern New England's largest commercial real estate services firm with offices in Portland, Maine and Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm your host, Jessica Estes. Our special guest today is Matt Hancock. Matt's a Maine native whose family you may be familiar with. After exiting the family's lumber business, Matt has focused on commercial real estate and has owned some interesting property in Maine. Thank you for joining us today, Matt.
Thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. So I'm excited for our audience to learn more about your real estate investments, but first let's talk a little bit about you and who you are. So you're a native Maina.
I am born in born and raised in Casco.
In Casco.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
It would make me a Lake Region Laker.
Are you still in Casco these days?
We are. We live right in Casco Village. It's right on Parker Pond in Casco.
Nice.
Great spot.
This is a perfect place to live if you're going to be in Maine, right?
Yeah, like, it's still got a good, there's a quintessential New England feel to it for sure.
Yeah.
small town, you still know a lot of people. It changes a lot in the summertime, like a lot of Maine towns do. I think we're just over 3,000 people of year-on residents, but that goes close to 15,000 in the summertime.
In the summertime. So, wow. Yeah, a lot more boat traffic on the lake.
For sure.
So people may know that you played basketball at Colby College, and you played in high school, I'm assuming.
I did. We had some great teams at Lake Region High School. Mm-hmm. We won a state championship in 1985. I'm dating myself. It doesn't seem that long ago until you say it and add up years.
It really
right?
wasn't that long ago at all.
No, nope. Sure.
What made you choose Colby?
My brother was at Bowdoin, and my dad went to Bowdoin, so it seemed like a good pathway to venture off. And then a big reason for it was the basketball program, a legendary coach. Some great athletes before me and mm-hmm. after me, and it seemed like Bowdoin was always a hockey school and that Colby was a basketball school.
Gotcha. So it suited you a little better.
Yeah.
So I did look at the Colby College website over the weekend just to make sure I have the most up-to-date information, and it looks like you hold at least 15 school records still in basketball. Is that... Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, that might be true.
Might be true.
I'm sure it is. Yeah, no, it was. We had some great teams. One of the things I've loved most about my Colby experience, even after graduation, we were fortunate. We had a legendary coach, Dick Whitmore, who was there from 1970 until 2010. So it was a 40-year legacy.
Wow.
You know, 40-year legacy of players and great teams and a lot of success. And that continuity of having one coach with that kind of leadership really blended all of us together. And so much so that I often find myself wondering who my real teammates were. The further you get removed, mm-hmm. the Colby basketball family is just one big team. It's not just the guys you played with for your 4 years.
And so many of you have stayed connected to the school as the years have passed. Since.
Yeah. I've really enjoyed my time with that. And I think it was. I don't think it's something as a college student that you think about mm-hmm. as much, because you're so. I think we're really into the moment in those college mm-hmm. years. I'm speaking for myself. I know I was. It was about this class. It was about this game. It was about this season. I don't remember waking up wondering what I was going to do after graduation or beyond. It just was very, very in the moment.
You've mentioned your coaches a couple of times, and it seems like a lot of people with successful sports careers did have coaches that were highly influential in their lives, and sometimes that influence extends beyond the court. So I'm wondering if you had such a coach.
Yeah, it certainly has, and I was there aren't many days that go by where I don't relate back to my days at Colby College. I mean, I graduated in 1990, so we're a number of years past that. Mm-hmm. I got my 30th reunion coming this coming in June, so wow. Which I'll be back for. But still, some 30 years later, or 34 years later, because I would have started there as a freshman. I still think often of some of the lessons and kind of some of the staples of our program. You know, Coach Whitmore was loyal. I mean, every time I see him, he's so loyal to his players, his assistant coaches, members of the community, of the Waterville community. So that always strikes me. He's a tireless worker, mm-hmm. and made us be tireless workers. We always played to win. Playing hard is one thing, but you know, if they're keeping a scoreboard, right, the objective is to win. And so we always played to win.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, the piece we were, he made us a resilient group, which is stuck with me. You know, I almost redid my whole scope of what a calendar would be. We'd have a morning practice on Tuesday and an afternoon or an evening practice on Wednesday, and he'd treat it like we had 2 days off. And we'd be looking around, what do you mean 2 days off, right? So how does this work? We don't have practice. We have practice Tuesday and Wednesday. That's not 2 days off.
And then after college, you decided to stay in Maine, raised a family with your wife, Tracy. You met her in college?
We were high school sweethearts.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, it was great. I was 2 years older than she was, and we were somewhere between really good friends, mm-hmm. and dating friends at that point in time. And then I left for school, mm-hmm. and then she left on her own path, and we were back at a mutual friend's funeral, unfortunately. But we were back in town at the same time, and. Yeah, we were both in between relationships, mm-hmm. and hadn't caught up in a little while, and it kind of led, what are you doing to tonight? And we went out for dinner, and then what are you doing tomorrow night? And we went out for dinner again, and then it happened maybe 30 nights in a row, and so it just kind of reflamed.
So, and you and Tracy have three daughters.
Yeah, no, they've been so much. I mean, they've been our life. For our oldest daughter just graduated from Colby herself last May. Mm-hmm. So we've now got a two generation household of mules, and she was the captain of the basketball team there as well. So she was a great athlete. My middle daughter left Maine and really thought that. Flip-flops and a t-shirt were better than L.L. Bean boots and ski sweaters and ski jackets. And so she is finishing up online, but is down at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. Mm-hmm. And she was a great athlete. They my two oldest daughters won a state championship together at Lake Region.
Oh, wow.
In 2014 as sisters, which was so fun. I mean, just so fun. Yeah, they put so much time and effort into it and worked so hard and had come close a number of times, and to see them have success, it was just, I was just so proud. So I'm so proud of them.
Great to see as a dad.
And then our youngest daughter is a junior in high school, so we're not quite empty nesters
Pretty
yet.
Pretty close. You but think she'll stick around in Maine or?
She is a great lacrosse and basketball player. And I think she might follow in the path of t-shirt and flip-flops.
Yeah.
She's looking at playing lacrosse somewhere in the South.
So, and you coached some of their basketball teams?
I did. This has been a real joy of mine. It's basketball has been a passion, and athletics in general, but basketball particularly for me became a a core part of who I am and my life. And I just, I'm not, this will be the first year. So I coached somewhere from kindergarten to middle school to high school to AAU to travel teams and everything else for 25 years. Wow. of girls basketball here in Maine. I actually feel a little bit like a fish out of water because I'm not coaching this spring for the first time since I can remember.
The genesis of your real estate career, if I'm not mistaken, it was buying timberland for the family business when you were young. And now might be a good time to say that you are Matt Hancock of the Hancock Lumber family.
Mm-hmm. Sort of. That's for sure. Yeah, yeah. I was my first, I call it my first thinking job. Which I would differentiate between cleaning the nail room or stacking boards or some other task to maybe instill values or keep out of people's hair or whatever it might be as right at
yeah.
that age
yeah.
is that was I was I had the opportunity to spend the summer working with my uncle Don, who was in charge of acquiring. Selling or acquiring new timberland assets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at first I just loved the idea of getting up in the morning and thinking rather than just physically laboring.
Yeah.
and I was really attracted to that opportunity. And you know, I think at the time I was reflective that, gosh, he really knows what he's doing, and this is cool, but I was still 18 or 19 years old. I'm not sure which summer it was exactly, but it was, so you're not capturing this and taking notes and saying, this is what I'm going to do and how it's going to go. But, but in the end, how interesting that really was my path in many ways.
Yeah.
And, gosh, I love those days. A couple of things that I still take away. He was a, and I don't know that, I think it's a term that we label, maybe other people use it, but he was a master tailgate negotiator. I mean, he could put people at ease. We'd drive in the woods, we'd drive to a log landing, we'd go see a lot owner, and you know, most of the conversations would happen at the back of your pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
And the pickup truck would go down, and you'd have a cooler of sodas, and he was really good at tailgate negotiations, and I just felt that I've tried to follow that. It's one thing to be a good and thoughtful negotiator over an email, or even on the phone is different. But standing on someone's deck or in a field or in the back of a pickup truck or in a log yard and to negotiate straight up, eye to eye, person to person, chest to chest, I think is a little bit different skill. He was really good at it. And I didn't take with him the idea that I have a wad of cash in my pocket when I go looking for real estate, because it's a little impractical.
Mm-hmm.
But I did take it to mean that you need to be ready with your finances should something come up. There's too much other diligence to do in deal making to then have to go figure out. I mean, you always got to figure it out a little bit, right? You got to figure out. You got to navigate deals in terms with the bank, and you got to, or lenders, private lenders, however it goes. But to not have it almost all teed up in advance, I think was really the lesson of, you know, a wad of cash in his pocket.
Sure,
that I took
sure.
away.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And then, so you had an investment career since then, really, right? You've been buying and selling real estate at some
yeah,
level.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it evolved to. And I didn't. Well, little did I know. Again, that summer I spent with him in high school that I've really reflected back on a lot in my career, that I would be in his role someday.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I worked at and then ran the our sawmills for Hancock Lumber for a number of years, and then we kind of felt there was a feeling in the business that the retail part of the business was growing rapidly. And the sawmill businesses were expanding and having a lot of success, and that our timberland had kind of, which was the start of it all. I mean, it was my great 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 grandfather bought a 400 acre timber stand back in 1848, and that's how the company started. And so it really was the genesis to how it all got going.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we started cutting boards and floating them down rivers and hauling them around, and that's how it got going. But as it kind of ramped for them for that to circle back around, it wasn't, I don't think it was, it certainly wasn't preordained. It wasn't orchestrated. It just was, it was a sign of the times. My dad, I have a brother in the business as well, and he's in charge of Hancock Lumber, runs it every day. That's what he does. Mm-hmm. But our dad died when we were young. I was 28, my brother was 29, and my brother was in the retail business, and I was in the sawmill business. And you know, as it expanded, we just felt like that the timberland side of the business, which was the formation and the foundation, really, of the whole enterprise, mm-hmm. had just kind of gotten dormant, and felt like there was an opportunity there, mm-hmm. To expand that, but also that it was an important piece to try to keep with the other parts of the business. So I ventured off into that, and then and before you know it, I was driving around like my Uncle Don, looking for timberland and buying land and selling land and
big wad of cash in your pocket.
Well, yeah, well, there you go, right? For yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Ready to make deals. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the most well-known property that you've owned in Maine is Mount Abram Ski Area,
yes.
which you bought in 2008.
When I think about Mount Abram, in or out of ownership, mm-hmm. I think about unpretentious. I think about non-factory. I think about an artistic community, and nostalgic. I mean, how many people do you know who say, if you get into a conversation with someone about where did you learn to ski?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mount Abram really has done that for generations. It's a generational business. People think about Mount Abram that way. And so we had built a home up there before the mountain came on the market in 2008, or I guess maybe that was 2007. No, it would have been 2008 when it came on the market. And yeah, we were there, and I was buying land and real estate, and there was an offering sheet and a confidentiality agreement and a series of price negotiations, and before you knew it, we were
proud owners of a ski mountain
in the ski industry. Yeah,
that's great.
How interesting.
So that must have been a big adjustment for you, a big learning curve, maybe a little bit of a learning curve to.
It's a tough business.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great business.
Yeah,
but it's a tough business. I
sure.
think. I mean, I think you can. There's a lot of parallels across industry and business. I think leadership and management and being strategic and being financially on top of things. I mean, there's a lot of consistencies of whatever you're running. But then there are the nuances of every business that I'm not sure I realized at first how much one might soak in through being at the dinner table your whole life in a lumber or timber or building material businesses. You hear stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when my brother and I used to go to the Hancock Lumber offices with my dad on the weekends, he'd sit on one end of the building, I'd sit on the other end of the building, and we'd sell lumber back and forth. I'd be 5 years old, and we're trading lumber across the ends of the businesses on these intercom systems. And my dad would get his work done, and we'd go to the gym, go to the ball field afterwards. But
yeah.
The little things you pick up about an industry or a business take that is just an accumulation of time. And when you dive into something new, and that business is really tough.
Yeah.
But incredibly rewarding, but really tough.
So when you say rewarding, you did have some accomplishments when you owned the mountain. So what
yeah.
are some of the ones
well,
you're...
I feel like I don't want to understate this, and it may sound I'm a little plain, but one of the things I would rate that's our greatest accomplishment
mm-hmm.
is that we stayed in business, and vibrantly so.
Sure.
I mean, and I think you know, at the core, that's really the goal of any business. I mean, people put a lot of fluffy words around it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't stay in business, nothing else follows.
Right.
So I think staying in business vibrantly is a is an amazing accomplishment in that industry. We did it for 10 years.
And so you sold it a couple of years ago?
I did. It wasn't, I was going to say it wasn't for sale, but it wasn't on the market.
Right.
Almost everything's for sale.
Everything.
What's not for
sale?
In
my business, we say everything's for
everything
sale.
Everything is for sale, I'm sure.
Yeah. Still a little hard to let it go, though.
It was hard to let it go. I didn't let it go entirely, interestingly. One of the things we did in 2000 and, let's see, I want to get this right here. So in December 2014, we commissioned what was at that time, and I think this is a really interesting topic, but at the time, what was the largest solar field in the state of Maine? And I kind of feel like we cracked the code on this because we built it ourselves, we financed it internally, took advantage of the tax credits and the investment tax credits that were there federally, and we got a USDA Rural Energy for America program grant, and we kind of rumbled through this and created what was then, for a small period in time, of maybe it was an acre and a half or 2 acres, the largest solar field in the state of Maine. Now an acre and a half or 2 acres of solar field is nothing.
Right.
For what we're seeing 30-acre plots and 50-acre plots and 100-acre, 1,000-acre plots are going to be popping up with solar, right? We've got a governor who's very supportive of renewable energies, and it's just really opened up an opportunity that we're seeing happen there. So when I sold the mountain, long story short, when I sold the mountain, I kept the solar field. And I'm a private utility, if you will, because we lease the solar field back to the electricity back to the existing. So I kept a little bit there.
Okay.
And then my partner Rob Lally and myself kept a little bit of land off to the side of One Mountain, so in case they do really well and there are more homes and more demand for great living spaces at Mount Abel, we'd be able to take advantage of that. So I'm not completely, and I ski there most every weekend anyway.
Yeah.
So it's all good.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it must be interesting to have ski seasons now where you don't own the mountain anymore.
Yeah, you know, I didn't notice this, but my brother said to me yesterday, randomly, purely monitoring on social media, how happy I look this winter, being in pictures and skiing and having time with my daughters and not worrying about, do we order red solo cups? Did we make enough snow? Why is this broken down? What's going on with the groomer? What, you know, all the things that would get in the way of pure mountain enjoyment. I love that business. I love the challenge of it. And I'm really, really glad we did it. And it was a great 10-year lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it was just, and I think very fortunate that we had an opportunity to exit it successfully.
So you and I met in Portland. You were touring one of my listings and you didn't buy it, but I don't hold that against you. But I couldn't find evidence that you really have invested in Portland.
I've looked at a lot of property in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I consistently come away with the fact that I feel like I'm one step behind in the Portland market. Every property I look at in Portland, I wish I would have bought, if I was going to buy it, I would have wanted to buy it 6 months ago or a year ago. And I haven't quite gone there. I think the other thing that's true, I grew up in a blue collar town and there's this thought that, right, you never go, no one ever goes, northwest in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you always go southeast. I mean, where if you live in Fryeburg, you go to Bridgeton. If you live in Bridgeton, you go to Windham. If you live in Windham, right? If you live in Windham, you go to Portland. You always go southeast. And I just, I actually like going north and northwest. It just is. It seems like it's against the traffic. And so I don't. I've never felt like I've had a command on the Portland market. And I have this. Aching in the. It's somewhere in the back of my head that I'm a step behind everybody else. And for whatever reason, I haven't felt that way in other areas that I have found, what I feel like I found really good opportunity in. And so, we'll see. I'm young.
So I remember calling you when you said you didn't want to buy the listing that I showed you. And I asked you, well, what do you want to buy? You know, I'm a broker, so I'm going to find something to sell you. And you said you like college towns.
I love college towns.
Yeah. Why is that?
And well, there's organic energy in college towns.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, it is an energy that you have to create. It gets created there. And I've invested in Waterville, in downtown Waterville, which I've got two great projects there. I've invested in downtown Lewiston. Mm-hmm. I've got investments in Wyndham, right next to St. Joe's College, or just down the street from St. Joe's College. And I've got a cluster of investments in Brunswick at the old Brunswick Naval Air Station, yeah. Now Brunswick Landing. I just find that, you know, there's a real desire when you look at tenants, right? What do tenants want? I mean, tenants want a good space at a fair price, something that's dependable and it fits their needs for the business. Of course, all that stuff, mm-hmm. right? But they also want to be part of a robust community. They want great places for coffee, great lunch opportunities, the arts, things that attract employees as well, affordable living, right? I mean, and access to talent.
Yeah.
And there's no place in the world that has a greater access of talent than college towns do. I mean, mm-hmm. It's the nature of what they do. It's their business is to recruit talented kids and then foster more talented kids. So you've just got this pool of really neat, smart people with progressive styles and thought processes that I just find. I find so attractive.
Good energy.
Great energy. Yeah, for yeah. sure.
So what are some of the more interesting real estate deals you've done in your career?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question because it's, I've done some really cool ones and some good ones that have worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I can only speak for myself, some that didn't work as well as I hope, but I think that's the nature of it. The one that has always stuck in my mind is the acquisition and then the spinoff of Tumble Down Mountain. It was it's what we call T6. It was a 15,000 acre property,
mm-hmm.
That was coming for sale, coming onto the market from a private seller, a timberland owner, and the parcel included Tumble Down Mountain. So I've probably hiked Tumble Down Mountain 10 times in my life, 15 times in my life. And it's one of the great. It's in the Mount Blue State Park range, and Tumble Down is this beautiful outcrop of rocks and trees and forest. And there's this small pond pool at the top of the mountain. And you hike up, and there's a couple ways to get up there. One is like straight up the cliff through the chimney. And people who have been there would know what we're talking about mm-hmm. there. And then, down to your shorts, jumping in, cold top of the mountain lake, and then going and then hiking back. So we bought that property. It was 15,000 acres. And then with partnerships with the Maine Bureau of Parks and Lands,
mm-hmm.
and the, let's see if I got this right, and the Maine Forest Service, and then an NGO by the name of the Forest Society of Maine, which was really instrumental in managing a conservation easement on mm-hmm. top of what it was. So I and my team bought 15,000 acres, held everything for a day. I think it was all of us, but there was a small group of us that went and hiked Tumble Down for the one day we would own it. Because then one day later, we spun off some high conservation values into different agencies around the state.
Mm-hmm.
But putting together this deal of multiple parties that had multiple issues, conservation values, timber values, and then keep the majority of it in and as a working forest.
Wow.
I think it was probably, well, certainly at the top of my list of the most satisfying deals we've ever done because we kept working forest. We protected the recreational amenities, the ecological amenities that were there. And it was a fabulous lesson that complexity sometimes can create right unique opportunities and values.
Yeah. Yeah.
The more complex a deal, sometimes people shy away from that. But there's really navigating room in a complex multi-party, multi-issue deal, and I just I really enjoyed that.
So you do look at lots of different opportunities in the market, and you're pretty creative. So what are the things you look for that might signal to you that something is a good investment?
the undeniable fact of business or investment is the decisions that you make and the decision-making process that you have of what to do with your available cash or your leverage that you have. That decision-making process really defines where you go as an investor or as a real estate investor. And so I think you've got to make consistent great decisions in your acquisitions and your investments. So then, okay, how do you do that? Well, for me, I know what's really important is a team of top and collaborators. I think you know, it's I'm sure we all get anxiety in this phase where you go through the even a cursory view of how it feels, how it sits, you know, locational, does it if it matches what I want, generally speaking, and different people have different criteria about where they want to be and all that stuff. But once you get through that and you dive into that period of, okay, I am going into the diligence phase with really good professionals on my side and yet not knowing if we're really going to close this or not. There's a period usually of 30, 60, 90, 120 days, I mean, whatever it takes, where you're feeling pretty exposed, right? Because having a great team of collaborators, whether that's banks, insurance advisors, brokers, and legal professionals. I mean, you don't get great collaborators without those people being in high demand. And if you're in the high demand, they can be expensive. And so you go through this period of that. But I find that if you can surround yourself with really, really smart people, and then don't anchor them. I see that as a mistake that some people make. They hire really good lawyers and then they give them part of the story, or they don't tell them about the bad stuff, or you talk with your insurance agent and you try to keep something from them because you want them to insure it afterwards, and it's got some baggage with it. Or I just think if you surround yourself with a collaborative team, then you got to be wide open with them, right? Because they can't do their job for you if you're anchoring them too. Sure. If you're giving them a piece of the puzzle. So, and then of all of those groups, I think for me, maybe, and I see it in the market, I think one of the most underrated advisors in the market are insurance people. I mean, they're just, gosh, they know everything about everything. That's their job. Right? I mean, that is their job to know every, and if you can happen to find an insurance agent who has a history with a building or a history of the property, and I mean, it just is, I mean, their information. I don't do a deal without talking to my guys that, you know, that I work with on my insurance end. I mean, they're just brilliant people, and I think they actually like being involved. If you involve them, I think people always see insurance people as a necessary evil, and I don't. I think that's a mistake. I think you can see insurance premiums as being evil, or you're like, gosh, that's a lot for this property. But the value and the knowledge and the insight that they have to the market and to risks, I mean, they evaluate risks all day long. Yeah. And that's basically what we do. So there's no one you're more aligned to in these deals than your insurance advisors.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember when we went through due diligence on a deal a year or so ago, you were talking regularly to the insurance people. And I thought that was pretty creative and unique. I don't see a lot of investors and developers taking advantage of those relationships. So now your secret's out. In 2019, you purchased the Lewiston Gateway portfolio, which is three office buildings, the land underneath the Southern Gateway Garage, and a couple of other parcels right there on Canal and Lisbon Streets in Lewiston. Tell me a little bit about that transaction and your plans there.
Yeah, this had like every deal did, had so many interesting parts to it. Well, let me start with the owner who I bought it from. So the owner who I bought the property from was an older gentleman, but someone who had done deals with my grandfather in the timber world. Back in the 70s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So before we really got into figuring out the finer points of how this might work and what each party might be willing to take for a deal, we rehashed a lot of stories and history and I think, you know, however you get there, if you can forge a bond of some kind of commonality or trust or something to work, a platform to work off, it helps a lot in the deal making process. But I think we're fortunate to have that history randomly. I didn't know at the time even who the owner was at that point when we started looking at that property.
Right.
And but I had been looking in Lewiston for a while. I've been so attracted to downtown Lewiston. I just think the resurgence of the mills and the mill buildings, if you follow it today, there's investors from all over coming to Lewiston, and the city feels it has a great feel to it. It's got great culture. It's got one of the best schools in the East, right, in Bates College, mm-hmm. And then USM is also in Lewiston, which adds a second layer there. Central Maine Community College is right next door in Auburn. So you've got inspirational thought that just crops up. And then you've got a very diverse culture there, mm-hmm. with displaced immigrants from around the world, longtime native Mainers that call Lewiston their home, some great founding businesses, multi-generational businesses, one of the great theaters in the state of Maine, the Public Theater. Oh, mm-hmm. my gosh. We're members there now. We try to catch every show that comes out. There's just so much to love about Lewiston. So I was on the Lewiston train for maybe 3 years, and I just really couldn't find the right scale, project size, configuration until the Southern Gateway came up.
I've gotten to know you a little bit as a landlord through the process of acquiring the Southern Gateway properties, and you've got three significant office tenants there. And I've noticed that you have an interesting perspective on being a landlord. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
You know, I spent, before I was an investor full-time, mm-hmm. I spent a lot of my career working in operational businesses, from sawmills to timberland businesses to companies, even though there was a real estate and investment component to that, ski resorts. And I enjoy sitting on my tenant's porch trying to figure out what they need to be successful. Because really, at the end of the day, right, and it never quite makes sense to me how sometimes acrimonious all the other relationships can be. But our success as building owners is really about recruiting and retaining thriving tenants in our buildings, whether those are residential in nature or commercial in nature. Our businesses don't succeed without the tenants. Mm-hmm. And so while there's a clear line between that's your business and you do what you want, I think there are a number of ways that landlords and tenants can work closely together. You know, there's usually in any deal, if people will dedicate themselves to doing this, there's a post-negotiation opportunity in almost every deal, right? You get a deal done because you never really know, you never truly know what someone else's line in the sand is, right, as they're mm-hmm. sitting across the table. But after the deal has been inked or it's effectively inked, right, there's an opportunity to, okay, how can we both increase value in this? I mean, there may be something that I took as part of this deal that really didn't matter all that much to me. Or maybe there's things in that deal to you that, okay, I got it, but it wasn't this, I didn't need to have this. And so I think there's always an opportunity to increase that. And that really becomes about trust and communication and understanding their long-term strategies. And that, how do you get that, is time. Whether that's hanging out and throwing ice cream socials or inviting folks for coffee or offering to tour their other facilities, which I've done in many cases, mm-hmm. not just the ones they're in, but understanding the whole dynamic of their business better.
For the past decade or so, we in Maine and really much of the nation has experienced a very strong economy, a lot of growth. And so because it's been 10 whole years, a lot of people in the business don't necessarily have experience with a downturn in the cycle. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for people who maybe haven't ever seen a downturn.
Investing needs boldness. I mean, when you invest, you've become bold on a topic or an asset or a property, right? And you're exercising boldness. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I've done my diligence, and I'm going to do that. I think there are great buys on the way up. I think there are great buys at the top. I think there are great buys on the way down, and I think there are great buys on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that the investor community or the investment community necessarily stops participating when the market changes. But what I do think is a reflection of okay, understanding where the market is, understanding that the tenant markets may be more in demand or decline, or the investment market may be more in demand and decline, because people like to buy things before it, right, on its way.
Sure.
And so I think it's really about analyzing something and analyzing markets rather than stopping and starting. And really, it shouldn't be the case that your balance sheet is needs to get tightened up or strong. I mean, it really should be tightened up and strong every day.
All the time.
In all the markets. And yeah. So I think if you're missing that, I think if you're sloppy on details, because we never really know when those markets are going to happen and when they're going to change and plan. We don't know when the next coronavirus is going to hit. This had nothing to do with the market, and here we are, right? And the Bowdoin College women's team this weekend has to play without fans in the gym, yeah. Right? I mean, all the stuff that can happen. You don't know, like the market can change instantaneously, as this is a great example of.
Sure. So looking into your crystal ball for the next 10 years, what do you see for the future of Maine and the real estate market here?
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested to see when the B locations or the Class B locations become Class A locations or Class C locations. Or do we have other entries into a Class A location? Does Lewiston become, does Waterville become, does Wyndham become? You know, and I think when we look at, when I evaluate Portland, I always feel like I'm behind on the A market list. Mm-hmm. And I can't quite keep up with it. And some of the pricing that you see, it doesn't necessarily make sense to me. But you know, some of the greatest growth that we have in Maine is happening in the B markets. And what's happened in Waterville in the last 3 years is astonishing.
Yeah,
in Main Street in Waterville has been on a downward slope since 1970. You could argue because as the mills leave and the factory jobs have left, and man, there's a tough, resilient a community there that have just held on. And then I think really at the impetus of the college, mm-hmm. Who once moved out of the downtown of Waterville up to Mayflower Hill, but is now coming back to the downtown because they grasp how important it is for the universities and colleges to be linked to their communities. It can't just be, this is our hill and this is your downtown and here's our line. And because I think as the world or the thinkers of the world try to solve global problems, trying to do that in a tower on your own or in a hill on your own, I just don't think it works. I mean, to solve real world problems, you got to be in the real world. Right. And I think that's, imperative there. But what's going on in Waterville? If you look at the growth, I mean, it's one of the fastest growing communities in the East. I mean, what's happening there with new businesses and storefronts and facade improvements and Colby moving a new dorm downtown and buying other buildings and building a new hotel, and that's really attracted I think investors with an affinity to Colby. A lot of Colby alums have invested in the downtown, and a lot of people who have nothing to do with Colby have invested in the downtown because they see the resurgence there. And at what point does that become a, you know, does that change market grade? And I'm really fascinated. It's great movement in Brunswick. There's great movement in Lewiston. There's great movement in Waterville. And watching where those where those communities and where those markets peak, I think is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes I think it. It certainly isn't a hyper market in Waterville. I kind of feel like people are still waiting there. And there's a lot of the requests that I've got for some of my spaces might be from a store shop owner in Fairfield, the next town up, who's on Main Street in Fairfield, that sees Main Street in Waterville doing something really unique that may not happen on Main Street in Fairfield or Oakland or Clinton or Pittsfield. Okay, mm-hmm. But... and so how do they get to Waterville and move their location to downtown and maybe still pay Main Street Fairfield pricing, which, you know, doesn't quite work because you've had to kind of ramp up and put more investment into the downtown. But there's to me, the way I describe Waterville is it's working and mm-hmm. it's advancing. And there's quite a pile on the sidelines still waiting to jump in. And it's hard to know when that's going to happen. And so then that leads you to when do you take a lease offer, right? You take it now, we wait in 6 months, or we wait in another spring season, do we miss something? It's a fun time to see when those really resurging markets click or move to a new class.
Yeah. Definitely feels like they're on the right track though, in Waterville. Yeah.
It seems like it. I hope they are.
It's been exciting to see.
It's been fabulous. Yeah. I hope they're moving that way.
Yeah. Agreed.
I'm betting on it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been an exciting, interesting conversation. If you'd like to learn more about the Bolus Company, please be sure to visit us at www.bolus.com. You can find us at The Bolus Company on Facebook and LinkedIn and at The Bolus Co. on Instagram and Twitter. And lastly, if you want to know the secret to owning real estate, it's pretty simple. Greg Bolus would say, just outlive your debt, but I would suggest that it would be helpful to hire a great broker along the way, too.